So this time it's, I'm not quite up to it. I'm going to try to be up to it. Michael, congratulate me. I just lost my job.
Congratulations. Liberation via termination.
Spoken like a poet.
I went down this road 2 months ago.
So. And we were congratulating him, and I was like, I can't do it, and then, okay, did it.
So what happened?
End of the quarter, Symantec's doing so well, making so much money, they're laying people off left and right. I don't understand it, really. They announced their numbers. Last year was their record-breaking thing.
I'll tell you what it is.
Called me up and said...
It's a way of making the numbers actually look good when they're having problems. You slash staff.
Yeah.
Lower your costs. Drive the people that are remaining. They're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it catches up with them.
That's all I can think.
It will catch up. I think I know how.
So is it Friday, don't come in on Monday, or?
Boss called me from Texas. Uh-huh. My boss is in Texas. My ex-boss is not. He says, I hate to be the one to tell you this on the phone, but I'm telling you this on the phone.
Uh-huh.
And that was that.
That's just right there, huh?
Yeah, your last day's Monday. And that's the end of the quarter. That's uh-huh. when they announce. That's where they get rid of jobs and things like that.
Wow.
So they give you a severance?
Yeah, anyway, 4 week severance, which is good, but
that's
I mean, it'd be better if the economy didn't suck and I was thinking, how am I going to find a job in a month, you know?
So my friend Jim, who used to come to the when these meetings happened back in Connecticut, Boston, he used to show up with his guitar, and he's a really good guitar player, and when he heard that there were meetings again, he was like, well, I want to come, but I'm in Connecticut, so... And then we thought, well, we tested it, and it's like we're going to listen to them play guitar right 3,000 miles away.
Awesome.
Yeah. Hello. Hello, Jim. It's Ray.
Okay, good, Kelly.
I think that we're ready to listen. You've got six people listening to you.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I'm gonna set the phone down in the middle of everybody in the middle of the circle, and you go when you go.
So I'm standing here on the track of life, and my ankle shackles, and I know.
I lived in Amsterdam during, was there 2 months? I lived in there like November mm-hmm. and December,
right?
And you could walk into the Van Gogh Museum and be meet you in the guard.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And so it's like you weren't rushed by a lot of people. You could go to, I went to the Rubens Museum.
Right.
Yes. And they're like, oh, screw Rubens. I go back to Van Gogh. But wintertime is the best. I mean, this is when hash was first made legal. It was 77. And I lived in the red light district. And we had a woman who lived downstairs who was like 60 years old and peg leg.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to turn tricks. And they would be either Greek or Turkish sailors around the age of 21 or 22. I think it was the peg leg. I don't know, but it was brilliant. I'd like sit up in the window and like watch her. I'd like, and I was like, one after another.
Oh man!
And there was like a Chinese gambling joint around the corner down the basement.
Uh-huh.
With a window, right? So it was great. It was like Bertolt Brecht. Like walking down the street, loaded, and it's like the prostitutes are falling out the window, you know, like this, the Chinese gamblers, the drug dealers. It was a great time.
All right, so Michael's gonna start the reading part of it of the night.
So I haven't really picked anything out. I did print things up though, which is different, so I can actually read them. I really want to read a Bob Dylan in Italian. I cannot resist. My favorite one to read in Italian is Ballad of a Thin Man. I hope you guys don't mind. I hope it's not too self-indulgent. Where is it? Ballad of a Thin Man. That's on Highway 61, right? Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Hope you don't mind.
No, go for it.
All right. I'm still practicing this stuff, so. Ballata di un uomo sottile. Entri nella stanza, la matita in mano, vedi qualcuno nudo, e dice che l'uomo ce la metti veramente tutta, ma non capisci proprio che io ci dici quando ritorni a casa, perché sta succedendo qualcosa qui, ma tu non sai. Che cosa non è così, Mr. Jones? Sollevi la testa e ti hai chiesto il posto e qualcuno indica te e dice wow. E tu dici che sono mie, cose mie e qualcun altro dice dove cosa. E tu dici, oh mio Dio, sono qui proprio solo. Ma sta succedendo qualcosa qui e tu non sai. Che cosa, non è così, Mr. Jones. Anyways, I'll stop it there. But
oh man, that was great.
I gotta get that down a little more. But it's,
you got the hand movements going on.
I love the Bob Dylan. The Bob Dylan in Italian, reading this like semi-loudly on trains through Italy. So that you're just enough of a freak, but not too much of a freak.
Like walking that line.
Movement! Movement! This is your sign. Here! Now! Take this exit. Coming up fast. Your car's worn out and your psychic radiator is blowing steam all over, incinerating the thoughtless children licking at the rivulets like icicles. Step up! Slam down your words. The ones you love and hate to love and hate to write. Have to write. Like a plague, scabies they are. Scratch and scratch, and anyone who stands too close gets a deadly disease that the doctor can't describe. Prescribe a shot and a glass of wine, but that's the fuel, not the antidote. Movement, movement! No need for time travel to tag today as the day when the psychic train wobbled on its rails and exploded in eternity's ecstasy as the hobo poets took shotgun pot shots broadside at the passing express. Movement! Movement! Show me your ticket, and I'll kiss you so deeply your knees will buckle and break, and your stomach will dissolve into love's sticky jelly. Unwrap your uncertainties and disintegrate your self-hate, because I love you, no matter who you are or what you write, as long as you believe. Believe until you can't cry again. Bang. Believe until my love throws you down on your hands and knees, lying prone, facing the redeeming Mecca sun, your face buried in the soft, damp decay of a forest regenerating itself from the bacteria and the shrinking viruses of disease decades going dark. Movement! Movement! I'll write my own Declaration of Independence. When I break free from the muse's satin shackles, the short, orgasmic pleasure of fucking the far beyond, replaced by the post-coital dread of becoming nothing. A sentenced spider who just spent his eternal sperm on a spontaneous widow not worth these webbed words left behind. Movement! Movement! Sign up right here and practice your performance. The judges are decapitated. The priests have all gone to sleep.
Very good.
So I've been thinking about the political campaign and Obama finally getting his due. And so I decided to write him a letter. And just, you know, it was last Saturday night. I was still employed.
This is a traumatic point.
Yeah.
Oh, you should have heard the letter that he wrote to Kennedy.
Yeah, I was kind of pissed off at him.
Yeah.
And then he went and had that damn brain thing, and I felt bad.
Then you felt guilty.
I felt very bad. It's like I caused it. That letter put him over the towel. That last neuron was hanging on. Anyway, so we were sitting over at Coffee Time Coffee House, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to write to Obama. What am I going to say? Do I just talk about how I'm feeling right now about the FISA thing, and, you know, or do I kind of let the last 8 years out and do I, and not speak for other people, but maybe share in their sentiment of it's been a long fucking decade, and here you come along, and you know you're saying all this shit, you know, and so I kind of like I filled myself with the last 8 years, just all of it, and this is what I wrote to him. Dear Senator Obama, I'm writing to you tonight in the full and hopeful expectation that you that come about 7 months from now, you'll be sworn in as the next President of the United States. You'll take the vow to defend the Constitution, be nodded toward by a group of important faces, and the cheer will ring the globe. You'll be a kind of new bride, not just to this nation, but to the 6 billion souls around the world who your words and actions will affect from that winter's day on. The nightmare of George W. Bush in elected office will be over. He and his criminal brothers will be pushed off the world stage, perhaps to continue their treacherous pursuits further in the shadows. But you, sir, will be the man chosen by a nation to bring its highest office back into common light. Let me say several things as preamble here. First, I would have rather that Al Gore take his rightful place at last next January. It was his to take, in my view, not yours or Senator Clinton's or Senator Edwards'. And certainly not John McCain's. He chose to defer, millions sighed and respected this choice. Second, much of what I think and feel toward you involves your own word, hope. As a senator, you did not stick out so very much. None of the Democrats have this decade. There is something of the coward in you each and all, that you saw the nightmare of George Bush and Dick Cheney and did not act beyond smoothly worded protests to bring them down. The wounds of this country and the world lay at your feet, and afresh each time soldiers die in Iraq, each time the American economy is raped new by the corporate elite, each time the corporate media whores reduce the complexities of human lives to an embarrassing photo or an intense argument about principles of law and morality few, if any of them, understand, much less care for when the day's headline has moved on. Hope. You came into our lives using that word, hope. It is a word for wishes, for suffering, spoken by the vulnerable, the desperate. You said it over and over until many of us became willing to keep listening, to allow hope again. We didn't lose it when the World Trade Towers fell on 9/11/2001, however it was that they came to fall. No, we began to lose hope more when we saw Bush obliterate Iraq for no reason, and nobody stopped him. Not the United Nations, not the constitutional separation of powers that says Congress shall declare wars. We lost more hope when Bush stole another election in 2004 and nobody blinked. We lost more as the death toll in Iraq climbed into the many thousands and was forbidden to be seen even on our televisions. We lost hope when we were told we could be locked up forever, when we were told we were being spied on, when our costs for bread and gasoline skyrocketed while the few made billions. So, Senator, you said hope, and we salivated. Our souls sweated for it. Hope, like faith, its close kin, raises even when there is no logic to it. This draws me near to my point. I don't expect you to cure every ill or solve every woe. Men will still hate for reasons of skin, ethnicity, sex, countless other even more ridiculous reasons. Children will still cry, adults will still get lonely and drink till the pain numbs. The elite of this world will still find ways to suck the planet's varied and plentiful tit like it was theirs more than others by divine right. No, you are one man with finite powers of office and intellect, and a big, big shit heap to go at. 8 years of George W. Bush smiling okie-dokie partners as he squats upon every creature in this world and lets his private shitstorm of demons fly in every direction, walk off hitching up his drawers and saying, "Y'all remember what I done for you." Senator, Mr. Obama, Barack, it's simple. Don't fuck it up. We will get you into office. By the millions will we get you there. Right now there's no real fight left in Bush's remains. Or like Jack Nicholson says in Easy Rider, they'll talk to you and talk to you and talk to you, but they're retrenching. Even a gang of rapists will take a break for a piss and a cold brew. We'll get you to next January, when you will take that oath on that bright winter's day. Then we'll do more than watch. We'll keep doing what's getting you to that day, what's pushing opposition from your path. See, being our hero right now is hard work, but I think it's kind of easy, too. Lots of pretty speeches, lots of pretty promises. No, sir, wait until you become our president. The one we blog and shout and phone bank and argue and canvas and donate for. Just wait. You will end the war in Iraq. You will stop the spying on American citizens. You will get us out of the prison cage of petrocrats. You will help the poor and the sick and the vulnerable of this nation, and you will rejoin this nation to the world of nations. You will become the world's number one advocate for peace among all men and women and healing with our mother planet. If you do not, if you deal from the bottom with the corporate jackal whores consuming all blindly these many years, if you go soft on defending the defenseless, if you turn to bullets and platitudes as though salvation, we will drive you, sir, from office to a place in hell that will look far up towards George W. Bush's. That's what it's like to have raised our hopes, to hold them, to ask we work our days toward that January day and your vow to defend the Constitution. That's what's going on, the spirits raised up and roiling right now. I will vote for you. I will work for your campaign after my own ways. I will cheer when you take office. But I will be with millions watching thereafter and still ready for whatever comes next.
Very good speaking voice, right?
Oh, thanks. That was, I haven't sent that off yet. I just typed angry. Up now.
I
just typed up.
A little angry. I like the passion there.
I read it to Cassie, and they say, I hope he doesn't think I'm threatening his life.
No.
But there's like no actual threats except we'll drive you from office. There wasn't like, we'll beat the fucking shit out of you and kill your wife or anything.
We're going to wait in the doorway.
Yeah. I don't mention guns or anything. All right. I've been working on a series of poems called Many Musics, and there's about 120 of them right now. And I've been working on them in series, and what I'm going to read to you is the beginning of the third series. You don't really need to know anything about the previous poems. It's all poetry's poetry. But anyway, where these feed in a little bit to this manifestation idea I was talking about, I was thinking about it in terms of like cameras and chalk, but I was also thinking about it in terms of words and sort of trying to work with it from different angles. So there's a series of poems that sort of gave me some of that. First one's Manifest. Remember that the photos of the park and the... Yeah, this is where I wrote this.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so... What won't come is music half-called, distracted, hungry hours sunk in the province of men. Lights, simmering smells, bread and stew, lure of wine and silk. Someone nods and says, "We're mapping beauty, an hour nearer, a formula, derived of striplings' coups and closely tuned compass." More smoke, distractions, distraction. Maybe the potion drunk an hour ago will be able to save the next. Music half-called rings back in blind cries and smoking metal, sentiments and easy lusts. Mapping beauty, another says, we can't feed ourselves and save the trees alike. What beauty in a hungry child or a burnt acre? Legions of men will be needed,
maybe more than all this world holds. Legions of men and centuries of days before anything known, or we even begin. Music, I call you now, from what I know, and much the rest. I call you now, music, where you tend, I will follow. What you know, I will believe. By stars' light and dream glow, will I map beauty in songs to manifest. Music, I call to you now. Each drift on his breeze, one wind, many winds, one rhythm, one melody, many musics, hear my vow. It's called Passing Water. Which I'm not sure is a... Is that a colloquialism for taking a piss?
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't...
not a sure vote.
So I was actually... when that phrase came into my head, I was imagining a circle of people passing a gourd of water. And then I realized later, oh, it's... Then there's that other... So, whichever kind of water you...
I'm gonna pass.
Yeah.
Let your water become one...
Yeah. I'd like to drink some reindeer water.
Well, isn't that how Amanita, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's Amanita. So anyway, passing water. Sing the hours true and know the hunger is bound in breathing itself. Its walls, beams, what girds underneath. Breeze moves each and all, one wind, many, and rains fall with the ceaseless questions and some answer. Want born, roots, thus music's bloom. Next hill may show whatever the burning smell in the air, or within heart's bluest scent itself, or where bound world's greater arc half risen. Sing the hours true. Chop wood, carry water, wreck every hour's pulse of promise and ache, what stays, what going. Ferment and strew, drifting lash on a curved warmth, news of today's annihilation in God's praise. Crack the wish to know notice newly, the long remembered pages lean wisdom. Dreams luring distant tree line. Every heart blows through empty fields with obscure intent. World manifests in you for its own reasons, many and none at all. This one is called Penury, which sort of means necessary jail, imprisonment. World evolves an hour to a train slow through grassland carrying new dead, to a long-waited kiss in rainy lake. Music half-called, deep hungry words, clear dreams of a dying man, a soldier cursing the strange land's heat, his own sad blood. What to do next when the wind and the lightning and the rainbow and the shutting door? Any of it. What to do next? Say the way is disillusion, call world an effect, crack the wish to notice newly. Manifest. Shit is beautiful, too. Look on to New Year's, their clustered seeds, unmet faces, chances brambled in mystery, eternals touched in finishing the song and crawling the dust. Look back, bravely, what spilt, what gone, calmly, what lingers, and what still it seeks through you. But this poem come from a moment where I'm along the path and I remembered sometimes when you're high, you're in constant motion, and you have to remind yourself to stop and just pay attention to one thing. Because if you do, you might have a really profound experience of just that one thing. You know, your mind's just like, this thing, next thing, you know, you want to gather all the toys together. Exactly. And so what you got to do is you just pick one toy and go into the other room and just, you know, grok with that toy for a while. So I was grokking with these leaves, and I was watching them, and I've never watched wind through leaves very closely enough to see that each leaf responds differently. Like, the leaves are not all... They're blowing in all the same direction, but the physical composition of each leaf is a little bit different. It's almost like raindrops or something, where, you know, they all look the same, and then you look a little closer, and, you know, snowflakes. So I was watching it for the longest time, and I'd forgotten how just taking your sort of high consciousness and really glomming on... You know, it's just like doors bust open if you just remember it. You know, knock inside or whatever. So this, I couldn't think of anything else to call the sensation of what I'm describing it. So I call this anything other than the word clean. That's the one that came to mind. Leaves everywhere shake, and I understand I know nothing. Trees above drink of earth and shine alike. I am nobody.
human paths through hills and bushes, decaying the moment the pick draws away. This hour is a gift to all, and my sadness is the struggle to share. What answer is a tapping in ourselves, a deep rhythm, source of knowing and nothing? Move nearer, know why, move on, sing, trust. What answer in godless hands that can shape dust to bullet and thus back again, or shape dust to a prayer of thanks, manifest a star in every seeking eye? Leaves are shaking harder now, everywhere, a language of both knowing and nothing, a pickless path, this hour's gift both spent and unspending. Move nearer the deep rhythm, sing, trust, move on, know why, and there never was. This poem is called Viva la Vida, partly because I was thinking about artists that I admire that, you know, get back on the beam and do the fucking work. And partly, I just like the phrase, I mean, long live life. Is that right? Is that proper Italian, Mr. Italian translator?
Yeah, it's
guy?
Latin. It's Latin. Yeah, but it's...
It's not Italian?
No. Because it would be... What would be in Latin? What's la vita?
Oh, of course, of course. So Viva la Vida is Latin.
The,
long live.
Yes, yeah. Okay. The,
I also had a dream where I woke up, and this is how the poem opens, and I've given away too much explanation for this, but anyway. But I don't know, I've never called a poem after an album title before. I mean, never even, like, White Album or something. You know, Dark Side of the Moon or whatever. Those are all good, you know, pretty good poem titles, but I was thinking about fucking art, and I woke up that morning with this phrase, fear falls frozen, dripping through the heart. That was in my head. I had to write it down. You know? That's why they fired me, because I was like, getting rough. They didn't fire me. Like, you know. See, I moved you from laid off to fired. The ego, man, the fragile ego. No, the fragile ego. I just keep saying fired.
You didn't get fired. You got shit canned.
Liberation.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Shit canned.
Via termination.
Shit canned versus via termination. Okay. Fear falls frozen, dripping through the heart. One in many wonder at its breathless wall. It's a lump of God within. How alone and why? Ask again. The cicadas and the bamboo too. Ancient astronauts taught us this far and left. Nodded, let go. Want, taught to want. To fear one hunger with another. To feed one hunger with another. To chase. To almost know, hurry through those brilliant ears, sensuous playing lights, saber tooth and brunts notwithstanding. Hunger, is it any more complex with men, larger, more men, larger cities? Does any falls tonight triumphant finale, glory for not another hour more? Fear falls frozen, dripping through the heart, great galleries and long centuries, preachers roar and kings thump, comfort in hovering together close over the abyss, aligning gazes and call it love, or gesture to maps and libraries, bullets, chalice, scripture, grave, solemn nod their truth, comfort in what hasn't slipped yet, and touchless faith will hold. Questions mirror glance to glance, and highest music only sighs and sings of full moons, midnight tides, and the moment's power and warm lying by warmth. Tonight behold the wide world with all its fears, howling and half awake, no key to explain, behold the world howling, half waking, yet still no key to the smallest face or least star. So I went to the Portland Museum a couple weeks ago, and has anybody ever read Hakim Bey? Taz?
I read him all the time.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of a radical, lefty, old school kind of writer. He came up with some ideas that led to Burning Man, but he was kind of in all
Taz.
That. Taz. Taz is the book. We're actually going to reprint Taz and bring it to Burning Man.
Temporary autonomous zone?
Yeah. He had this idea about grabbing some space and liberating it. Doing something
temporary.
With it, and then moving on. But
guerrilla theater.
But he had this great
guerrilla life.
He was talking about the word insurgo, which I don't. Is that Italian or Latin?
It's Latin.
It means insurgent.
Right.
And I was really getting into that, and. So that was one part, and so I went to the Portland Museum because there was this show of the Northwest Artist Award winners. That's like their summer show. And finally ended up in my favorite, and this is where I wrote this, favorite room in the Portland Art Museum, which is the photography room, which reminds me of the Buddha room at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's shadowy and it's peaceful and it's quiet and it's full of really funky. Like, they must be really proud of the photography collection there because it's really good. And they mix it and match it so weirdly. You know, they'll, like, three or four pictures from the 20s and then next to a picture some guy took last week and they just got donated to him or whatever. So I was sitting there very peaceful, and I wrote this in pencil because you're not allowed to write pen. So I have my museum pencil I keep with me for when I go to museums. I keep it in that pocket. You know, because the guards always come at me. They see me with my big black pen and they're like, nah, you're going to...
Frank, you might sign some of the artwork.
Yeah, exactly.
This one's mine.
I'd had a really good day, which is good because this is one of my last really good days at that company. But I had a really good day, and the last moment I'll tell you about is when I was going on the Max over the water, I was looking at that weird, like, grain refinery storage thing, whatever the fuck that is.
The small grain elevator by the
And I was just marveling. I was like, wow, that's in the middle of Portland. It's in the middle of the city. There's this, like, weird grain elevator thing. Whatever.
Pakistanis love to take wheat out of there.
I bet.
It's a long story, but yeah, 50% of that wheat from there goes to Pakistan. So they love that wheat.
So the sixth of my six poems is called In Sergio of 619 only. Old thoughts crowd the peak, obscure both sky and valley. The years conspire to narrow faith, harden and systematize what it becomes. Worship words without burn. How long stable this living machine? Look to how dear men bear the crumble of other centuries, and yet little wreck its warning. Old thoughts on a familiar train crossing a local river, some factory crowds its edges. I witness this passing hour and nod to its sky, its valley, what treasure it keeps, what it passes along.
Okay, this is a letter to Philip Whalen from Gary Snyder in 55. This is just right before Ginsberg read Howl. And this is a letter, actually, he's writing to Whalen saying that, we're all getting together down at this gallery and we're going to all read together. Right? September 1955. And you could really see how Kerouac was probably really influenced by this guy's letter writing style. Mm-hmm. Here we are back from the Sierras, which proved, finally, when I took a trip on my own, 10 days by backpack and only partially on trail, to be possessed of a certain charm and isolation. Old Harry Lamley wrote and said that you were planning to come to the Bay Area to live this year. Now, if this is true, and I hope it is, you must come as soon as possible, because you are scheduled to read some of your own poetry at a reading that will be given at Sixth Gallery on First Friday in October. There will also be poets Philip Lumantia and a person named Allen Ginsberg, who I've met recently, who is the person who wrote the letter about images of cloudy light to Williams in Patterson, others in me, and Kenneth Rexroth will do the introductions and such. I think it will be a poetical bombshell. I got you in on the deal on the basis of three poems, Martyrdom, K.W. Cynex, and If You're So Smart, which have achieved a certain subterranean celebration via Rexroth and others. Rexroth got me in. Otherwise, Berkeley is a pleasant place to be. My cabin is quiet, and I study Japanese. I planted two pines and placed two granite rocks in a felicitous manner. Mrs. Lirum is full of spirit. Chandel is in good health, and I have taken to baking my own bread on a recipe borrowed from Valerie McCorkle. I gave my car to Mr. and Mrs. McCorkle, who live in Sausalito, to ease the task of running a family about it. Let's see. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. And this was one more letter. See, that was from September 55, and this would be in January of 56.
Didn't he, when the whole beat thing hit, wasn't he in Asia?
He was studying Zen in 61.
Yeah,
he went over. He was shipmates. After he did this, he signed on. He could no longer work for the Forestry Service because of his work with the union, a union back in New York that was indicted by our friend Joe McCarthy for being a communist inspired union. He couldn't get work in the United States. He could no longer work as a guy up in fire tower.
Oh.
So he left, and he shoveled coal across to Japan.
Yeah, it's in his letters. He talks about traveling all over the ocean.
Went to India and stuff like that, but he ended up in Japan in 57. And
did he get married?
Yes. And he divorced her in 72.
But this was another little one, so a short one. And it's kind of funny because he's talking about trekking through the terrain, you know, up where I live. And, you know, he's talking about Reed and here. Again, this is January 27, 56. Dear Phil, a long snowy ride up 97 through Warm Springs got us safely here. A night at Durham's, a night at Baker's last night, and tonight to be at Goodlatcher's. Everyone at Reed passed the idea of our reading to someone else, so we made our own arrangements to be sponsored by Janice and Reed in K-Park Monday, 8 p.m. and the 13th. Lloyd's class was signed. Almost a foot of new snow on the ground. I went skiing last night on Waverly Golf Course. Logging is still going in places. Ginsburg bought a pair of cork boots at Goodwill for $2 and wants to work in the woods. He's reconsidering rhetorical poetry and says it makes him feel foolish to shout, Moloch! At fir trees. The hardness and cleanliness of Greek students I've talked to is gratifying to see. The hardness and cleanliness of Reed students I've talked to is gratifying to seeing, and in a way, still better than anything else in the Bay Area, devoid of all self-pity and all camping. Sorry. Goodlatch doesn't like the stuff I wrote this fall, too personal, he says, but does like the myths and the texts and the berry feast. Liked Kerouac's poems best of all. Everyone remembers you. We go to Seattle Sunday. Goodlatch has a quantity of blossoms, and we mean to walk rainbows tonight. Gary.
Oh, that's a good one. I'll go for the sci-fi. It's a little something different. I'm an avid reader, but I guess that prefaces because I'm starting out towards the end of a short story. 50-60 sci-fi is just brilliant because it really had to be very imaginative.
Philip K. Dick.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, they didn't have a lot of technology back then. It's just very progressive stuff. I love that era. It's a heyday.
They had to use a lot of cool names for things.
Yeah, this story, it's about Earth kind of, you know, went south, and humanity, driven by desperation, which is a breeding ground for innovation, left planet Earth. This is a story about a group that kind of, they left, but they also time traveled at the same time, and when they came back, all humanity was gone, and the Earth was just, you know, they just were on their way to a different star system. They stopped by the mother planet, and they land their spaceship on it, or one of the exploratory ships, and they notice this landscape filled with, you know, acid pools and solar-powered kind of things just all over the place, and moving creatures, and they figured out that this silicone-based life form evolved based on all the machinery that was left back on the planet. And there's this group of kind of intelligent, evolved, predator, primitive robot animals. And they find
like
the ship.
Sounds like the description of WALL-E.
Well, I don't know. But they find the ship, and they're like, oh, hey, we could salvage this, or that might be dangerous. And, you know, when the humans go out to take a walk, one of the robot predators grab them and take them back to their cave, which his wife or mate robot is there.
Do they eat?
What?
One of them
kind of tears apart one of the humans, just to take a look at it, you know, it's really gross. But at any rate, one of the humans escape and gets back to the ship. She thinks she's kind of figured out how to communicate with them.
Who's the writer? Who's the writer?
Paul Anderson.
All Paul Anderson.
It's called Time and Stars, 60 Cents, published in 1965.
Kind of thing you get in a Greyhound station in Des Moines.
Yeah, it's just pocketbooks. Pulp fiction. It's okay. Okay. Zero, the main role, one of the big robots, who had won his wife, think about, mustered decisiveness. It is not hurting us, he said. I am glad not to be as close as the hunters are, but even they should be able to endure it for a while. We shall see. Come, let us two go back inside once we have secured our prisoner. The monster began to talk, monster meaning the spaceship. It's broadcasting on radio frequency. No mere outrageous cry this time, but speech. Not words, except occasionally, a
few images, but such occurrences were coincidental. The monster spoke in its own language, which was madness. Seized along every radio receptor channel there was in him, total sensory and mental linkage. Zero became the monster. Dit, 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 da, dit, null, 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 dit, dit, da, da, and the velociter sum, infinitesimals, infinitely added from the null to infinity, dit, dit, da, dit, 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 null, gamma-colored chaos, bang, goes the universe, scattered stars, planets, burst the fire, block that neutron, block that neutron, block that neutron, one, one, non, non, null, da, da, dit, dit, chitter, 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 burning suns and moons, burning stars and brains, burning, 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 da, dit, da, dit, da, dit, da, dit, give me 50 million logarithms this very microsecond, or you will burn, dit, 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 da, 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 and one long, wild logarithmic spiral down space, time, energy, continuum of potential gradient, x product, I, j, k, but multiply time by the velocity of light and nothingness and the square root of minus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, change, for duodecimal computation, zzz, buzz, integral over sigma of del cross hd sigma equals 1 over c times integral over sigma partial of e with respect to t dot t sigma, but correct for non-spherical shape tribe coordinate transformation quantum electrodynamic discharge electroscale phasor gradient temperature as long rising to bring burning, 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 dit, dit, chitter, 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 from eerie to blind gnar, and back again, oh help, the trunk is burning, 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 therefore annul, in the name of the seven thunders, everything that has been, break up the roots of existence, and strike flat the thick rotundity, oh the world, rip space-time across, and throw it on the upleading primordial energy, for now all that is, and was, will be, the very fact that it once did exist is cancelled and torn to pieces and burning, 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 burning. As the sun fell down the bowl of sky, the sky cracked open, and the mountains ran like rivers, forming faces that gaped and jeered, and the mountain rose in the west and spat the grisliness of what he had done at him. Zero ran. Seven did not, could not, lay by the cave entrance, which was the gate. Which was the gate of all horrors and corruptions, as it turned to salt. And when God descended, still shouting in his tongue, which was madness, this fiery tail melted Seven to a pool. 50 million years later, the star called Wormwood ascended to heaven, and the great silence fell upon the land. Eventually, Zero returned home. He was not surprised to find that the biped was gone. Of course, it had been reclaimed by its master. But when he saw that One was not touched, he stood mute for a long while indeed. After he roused her, she who had been awake when the world was broken and refashioned could not understand why he led her outside to pray that they be granted mercy now and in the hour of their disillusion.
Wow. Well, you two are here. Can I read one more poem?
Yeah.
I want to read this one poem just because I love it. This is my new all-time favorite poem.
That means you've loved it and hated it, and now you're running.
No, I've never loved this poem before.
Never
I've
loved
just it. Heard it. This is Philip LaMancha.
Oh, okay. So it was one of yours.
I wanted to get you. I have been looking. I need to order. Basically, I want everybody I know to have copies of this book.
Right.
It is so incredible. This is the best City Lights I've done in years, and it's one of the picture, of course. Yeah, it's their latest in the Pocket Poets, number 59. What it is, I explained it to you, right, about Philip LaMancha. Philip LaMancha was a San Francisco poet, a surrealist. He was at the Sixth Gallery reading. At the Sixth Gallery, which is where Ginsberg, actually at least the second time he read Howell, the time it gets all the notoriety, the first time, or time before, was it Reed. Anyways, LaMancha only read
which
the poems.
Which Snyder was talking about in what Victor was reading.
Exactly. LaMancha went to the Sixth Gallery and only read the poems of his friend John Hoffman. And this book collects both a LaMancha manuscript that was thought to be lost and the only manuscript known of John Hoffman. LaMancha burned all of his old poetry when he became a Catholic.
Were you telling me that?
No, he was telling us that last time.
Yeah,
okay,
but then
okay.
Stuff popped up, and then this poem here has become my new favorite poem. It's called The Owl. This is a LaMancha poem. I hear him, see him, interpenetrate those shadows warping the garden pathways as the dark steps I climb are lit up by his eye magnetic to the moon. His eye magnetic to the moon. I have not seen him when windows are mute to whisper his name On that moment, erroneous bats slip out through the sky. His lair conceives my heart. All hearts make the triangle he uses for a nose, sniffing bloodways to the brain. Bloodways are lit up by his eye. On a sudden appearance, he tortures leaves, flays branches, and divides segments the sun has drawn. I do not falter. In the dark, he fortifies. His color is green-green to distend him over the earth. He does not fly. You meet him while walking. He is not easily enticed to manifestation, but stony silence, petrified moments, a transfiguration will bring him out. Focused on the screen where all transfigured bodies are, you must be humble to his fangs that paw the moon ball dissolving in the space from the corner of your eye. He will trick you otherwise into daylight where you meet his double while running. By night, the deltas... By night, the deltas of the moon-spilled planet stoned under his wriggling light. By day, he chokes the sun.
I think that...
So anyways, it's my new favorite poem. That's The Owl.
It's by my friend Ralph Emerson.
But not Ralph Waldo.
No, Ralph Huggy Emerson. Yeah. He's been my friend since high school.
Is he any relation?
I don't think so.
He feels
Massachusetts, though.
Connecticut.
He's got to be related.
I think so, but, you know, they would never admit it. Him and his dad are both named Ralph. With different middle names.
It's called Encounter.
Yeah.
A moth on my book in nighttime lamplight. Off, or I'll crush you. Oh, your black eyes, your quivering antenna, your coiled snout. Uncoiled! How you thrill when I touch your antenna tip. Leap back, examine me. Alive with curiosity, crawl down my book, up the page. You are a dragon, an angel, a winged horse, a young sage. Your black eyes, your gold leaf wings, fringed like old armchairs. You, alive, aware of me. Yes, onto my fingers, my hand. I'll put you outside. All right, then fly off. Wheel around my ceiling. See if I care. But then you land on my arm, you beauty. You wheel for me. Come to the window, sweet as the night air. I raise the sash with you on my wrist. I'll blow gently, and you fly off. And I do. You do. Are you off okay? Good night, then. Live well.
That reminds me so much of that Ginsberg little Zen poem that he's got.
Uh-huh.
It goes, something I'm going to paraphrase, I can't quote it exactly. What is this little insect walking zigzag on my page of Zen poem? I blow you into the shining void.
Let me try to read some of this out here. I got a fucked up story, man.
This one's hang loose.
This book is so awesome. It's put together by this little press somewhere, Lord. Portable Lower East Side. I picked it up at the college in one of those used book bins.
Coming, I see.
And it's all stories about chemicals, right? So it's all different stories related to all sorts of kinds of different chemicals. It's all short stories. There's a couple of heroin junkie stories in there. There's a story about a transgender doing hormonal therapy. Sugar junkie, the Rogaine junkie. All the Rogaine junkie stories, but
Rogaine—that's the gray hair.
That's the hard medication they rub on your head to bring back just the little vestigial hair.
Yeah.
And as soon as you quit using it, it all goes away again. But this one was a fucked up story written for people that were simply high, right? And this story—you almost want to like put down a board and some diagrams because whoever wrote this story. Now, you'll get you'll start to read into it, and then they'll introduce a character, right? But now the guy who's writing will include that character, like the dog or the goldfish, just completely like a human. So it's like, so the dog or the human, will, or the dog or the goldfish will reply like a human,
uh-huh.
Or, you know, so it's kind of creates a strange sort of picture. But, let's see if I can even read. But this guy, it's just such a funny story. It's called The Lingering Smell of Hot Dogs. Whatever you do, don't mix the Drano with this clobber, Romero, the hardware owner said to Barney Day.
Is it any good? What's in it?
Barney asked, looking at the plastic gallon bottle in Romero's hand.
It's sulfuric acid. Just read the directions, senor. You always read the directions. Don't mix. You're a bartender. You mix all day, yes?
Romero laughs, enjoying his increased knowledge of English.
Barney coughs up a laugh.
Romero hands Barney the bag with the clobber. He gives Barney a smile along with his change. Barney steps into the pet shop. He needs some fish food for his neon gobbies, Antonio and B. He then stops at Leo's Deli for a quart of brine gold. While there, he picks up a treat for Welma, his parrot Tuon. Welma had been complaining recently that Barney was taking her for granted.
You never bring me shit anymore. A couple of bloodsucker worms, sunflower seeds, nothing. I'll fly out this window one of these days, so help me.
She threatened.
This is the bird?
Yeah, that was the bird. The treat was in the box next to the water guns, the plastic soldiers, sheriff's badges, that kind of stuff. It's called the Bendit family. Perfect for dollhouse play, it says. It's a rubber family. Mom and dad, little sister and little brother. Rubber bands around their necks and feet shackle them to the cardboard wall of their living room. The front of the box is made out of clear plastic, catering to the peak freaks out there in the world. They're an irregular family. Dad's wearing a bright lemon shirt, apricot tie, plum-colored pants. His arms akimbo, it looks like he's saying, "Dig how luminescent my clothes are, dude!"
Mom next to him looks a little stunned, like she just stepped off the gangplank from Czechoslovakia with two American dollars in her pocket and nobody to greet her. She's missing a couple of teeth. Copper nicotine fingers, doesn't know what to do, hide her wedding band she's wearing. What the fuck does it matter what she's wearing? Do you care? I certainly don't. They end up in Wilma's cage being pecked to shit fucker. I love how he just develops that, right?
Barney holds the door open for the whistling mailman. Barney's halfway out the door trying to remember the name of the tune the mailman's whistling. He can't think of the title. He hates that when the mailman pull that shit. He presses the button for the elevator and goes to check his mail. "You've got to be kidding," he says. He's pulling out bulky manila envelopes that are stuffed inside. Plaster is spitting that they're so fat. "This isn't funny anymore. They're mail order catalogs from chemical companies. They've been coming for a month now. Pictures inside the catalogs of wizened-faced train conductors with oyster white hair standing in overalls and waving to you besides vacuum-sealed freight trains with names like Santini Brothers Chemicals, Dracket Producers Company, Lineal Chemicals, and King Spray Products. The catalogs give the history of the company. They also talk about the donations to the Rainforest Preservation Foundations, give their wholesale prices per freight car, suggested real tip, retail prices, profit margins, etc. On the last page, the same damn photo of the founding fathers. Three fat, balding brothers with teeth clenched down on cigars, rich American smiles with dried saliva from prostitutes on their dicks.
Barney's paranoia is getting paranoid. In a frenzy, he rips the address labels off, opens the door to the elevator, looks around the lobby, listens for the lock tumblers shifting. Nothing. He shoves the catalogs between the elevator car and its door and lets them drop.
Oh.
Barney thinks they flap like falling seagulls filled with shotgun pellets.
Oh.
Barney has a thing with seagulls, as you'll find out later. "Why don't you throw them into the regular garbage?" He couldn't tell you. If pushed, you might scream, "Fuck you, I'm a delinquent bartender. I am unjust, but I can strive for justice."
Oh.
It's been 40 years since I worked at the Atomic Energy Commission. Who are you to stand in judgment? Let he who is without sin.
Wow, Barney's got a lot of backstory there.
Oh, but it gets weirder. Okay, let's see. This one gets there's a little dry shot here. You have to bear with. This is where I thought the story almost took a serious turn when I first read it. I was like, "Oh, this sucks." That was progressing weirdly. No, it turns out he's just kind of a straight man for a second here. What's my whistle, please?
Is this your water glass or your wine glass?
Wine glass. Yeah. Just a little bit. Oh, that's okay. Thank you. Let's see. Barney worked at the Atomic Energy Commission in Oak Ridge, Tennessee back in 1948. In 1946, the AEC was given full control of all phases of atomic energy. It acquired from the Manhattan Project the vast empire of laboratories. 41,000 people worked there with no central management. The Cold War was on. The Soviets had just detonated their own atomic bomb. The U.S. went into a frenzied nuclear weapons buildup, and guess who got the job? Young Barney Day was well-oiled the night that he heard of the sailor talking of the plans for the future in the bar on Fordham Road in the Bronx. The sailor had a friend from the Navy who lived down in Oak Ridge. The buddy of his was going to fix him up with his sister and also get him a job at the AEC. The sailor was leaving the next day. Barney wanted to break out of his home. His old man was an abusive drunk. He'd hit his wife, his kids, blow his paycheck at the corner bar, punch out the bathroom windows, flush kittens down the toilet. Barney went into the bathroom of the bar that night. "I don't want to become like that motherfucker," he slurred. "I need to wake up," he continued. He threw cold water on his face, his balls, his neck. It did the job. He followed the sailor into the building. The sailor lived on the fifth floor of a poor tenement. Barney slept on the roof landing. Barney planned to follow him around the next day, hoping opportunity would lend him to do the guy a favor. The sailor left his apartment that morning with a suitcase and a tuna sandwich and a wax paper in his coat pocket. As he was coming down the stairs of the stoop, Barney was right behind him. Out of the sky, screaming for a crash landing, came a mammoth seagull from Coney Island. The seagull was banging the wife of one of the managers at Nathan's. The guy came home, caught the seagull with his beak and his wife, and her massaging his balls with his aloe vera. The guy pulled out a .38 that he kept in his sock, a sock nailed above his bed.
Seagull?
Yes.
Okay.
The guy started shooting. She got three in the back. She was in cold storage. The seagull crashed through the closed window. The poor bird got cut up pretty bad. The blood was gushing out of him like an open fire hydrant. He was just beating the bone-dry air with his newspaper wings, thinking that he'd make it to the Orchard Beach where his mother lived.
The seagull.
Yeah. He gave up the ghost over the Bronx. He came plunging down to Bailey Avenue, all 30 pounds of him. The seagull was about to knock heads with the sailor. The sailor saw the bird, was stunned, paralyzed. Barney pushed the sailor off the stoop. The seagull went soaring over the heads of the two of them through yet another window right into a pile of free samples of a new product called Windex. Barney saved his life. The sailor owed him one. Okay, because you remember in the original scene, Barney bought clobber, and he was told not to mix clobber with another drain cleaner.
Yeah, clobber.
Barney has to be to work in a couple hours. There's some errands that he needs to take care of. He has to get a move on with some things. He needs to shave, but the frickin' sink is clogged, the reason for the clobber. Why doesn't he use the kitchen sink, some smart-ass reader might ask. Well, he doesn't have a fucking kitchen sink. Is that okay with you, bud? He steps out of the elevator, walks up to the door. There's a pea-green vomit on his welcome mat. Beulah, his next-door neighbor, has an old Irish setter named Big Toe. The Irish mutt has an ancestral genetic predisposition for drinking toxic liquids. His favorite is antifreeze. On seeing the emerald green liquid snaking down the hill, he plays dumb, tells Beulah, "Hey, Mute, is that a well-hung man over there in the bush waving at you with a can of Ready Whip?" She falls for it all the time.
Big the Toe says this?
Yeah. Okay. Big Toe acts nonchalant, unfolds his beach chair, puts a dab of Noxzema on his nose, blows the dust off his sunglasses, stretches out, then opens up his copy of The Irish Echo and pretends to read. When Beulah crosses the street and he is out of her line of vision, he tears ass and guzzles the poison down, scooping the remains into a plaid flask. When I'm returning, well-oiled, drunk as a wheelbarrow, he throws up on Barney's doorway. Barney switches welcome mats with Beulah. Some butch tell her doc that what he's doing to his liver, Barney thinks. Beulah's in the kitchen. She's reading daily affirmations from a 12-step program to Big Toe. He sprawled, dead to the world, beside the table. To live a spiritual life, Victo, we must first find the courage to enter into the desert of our loneliness and change it by gentle and persistent efforts into a garden of solitude. Yeah. Victo yawns, wipes the dried throat from the corner of his mouth on the hem of her dress. He leaves. Beulah feels abandoned. He goes into the bathroom and jerks off to a muscular Dalmatian in midair above a green valley on the label of a can of Alpo. He comes. He feels downcast. His life is a joke. I'm going nowhere. Masturbation is for dreamers. I'll never meet anybody isolating as I do, he thinks. He reads the ingredients of the can.
Isolating as I do?
Yeah.
Oh, isolating as I do.
Yeah, this is all from the dog.
Yeah.
All these chemicals. Looks like the formula to the nitrogen bomb. How could she feed me this shit, he says. Beulah tries to find a song on her AM radio that will lift her spirits. She can't find anything. Barney runs into the bathroom with his tea kettle in his hand. He's addicted to caffeine. He dashes back into the living room, places the kettle on the electric stove, opens the door to Wellness Cage, throws in the Benda family inside, sprinkles food in the aquarium for his neon gobbies, Antonio and Bee, and he pulls out a gallon of clopper. Without reading the directions, he pours it half a quart into the standing water. Nothing! 7 minutes later, still nothing! He steps back from the sink, pours in another half quart. The water hisses. A thin curl of smoke rises, silent like a dream, parts like a cloud. Still, the water stands. 10 minutes later, he's drinking his tea, looking at the liquid clobber spread like a rumor over the surface. You little shit, he says. He spits into the sink. The caffeine is making him grit his teeth. It's his sixth cup today. He's getting bad ideas. He squeezes his kneecaps together. 3 drops of urine, kisses underwear, then get cozy, then take a nap. He pours the remaining quart of the clobber into the sink. Nothing! He eyes the Drano beside the toilet bowl.
Uh-oh.
He licks his lips, squeezes his penis. 3 drops of seminal fluid jump onto the backs of the three sleeping drops of urine. They all cuddle together and make small conversation. Someone turns out the light, then the cork on the wine bottle pops. He pours in the Drano. The water sounds like rock candy screaming between the molars of a gorilla at the zoo. The explosion occurs. A toxic cloud envelops the bathroom. Barney inhales a mouthful before escaping into the living room. He has a racking cough. He's burned the lining of his epiglottis, larynx, trachea, bronchia, alveolar ducts. His diaphragm has a hole the size of a dime in it. He grabs Wellma's Cage, pulls her out into the hallway, picks up the little aquarium with his neon gobbies, puts them next to Wellma. He opens the living room window, runs to the front door, jimmies it open with an Andy Williams album cover, and bends out the joint. Big Toe smells Barney's parrot and fish in the hallway. He twists the lock on the john and runs barking because the dog was still in the bathroom masturbating to the can of Alpo. He twists the lock on the john and then runs to the bottom of the front door. Wellma screams for Barney. The fish hide in their day-glow castle. Big Toe is yelling like an idiot. He's overdoing it. He feels guilt from all this incident with the Alpo can. He tries with the barking to plug himself back into nature. Big Toe, hush the fuck up, will ya? You frightened the shit out of me, Beulah yells. I certainly hope not, he says to himself. She pushes the chair away from the kitchen table. She rips the linoleum with the foot of her chair. Sees what she's done, bangs her fist on the table, breaking a nail. Big Toe sees this and tries to get out of her way quick as she storms to the front door. But he's not quick enough and gets a kick to the rib. That fucking bitch, what's with all this recovery garbage she's reading? Just look how she treats me, goddamn hypocrite. May God blind you, you dirty bugger, he says in his deepest Irish brogue. She opens the door and sees Barney choking, tears running down his cheeks. Mr. Day, is everything okay? Beulah asks. Does it look like he's okay? Wellma screeches. Shut up, Barney, says to Wellma. Gets the Flintstones reference. In front of this broad, you say that, Wellma says indignantly. Barney kicks her cage. It rolls down the hall. Big Toe is pulling boards out of the floor. He wants parrot for lunch big time. Antonio and Bee smell Big Toe's bloodlust and swim down into the castle's basement. In the basement is an abandoned head shop from the 60s. Psychedelic 3D record covers are strewn on the floor. Blacklight fixtures nailed into the velvet walls give life to the day-glow Zodiac posters. Candles, incense, marijuana pipes, bamboo paper, skull and crossbone rays are displayed in glass showcases.
the two fish swim about, checking it all out. Radical, B says to Antonio. Totally, says replies Antonio.
Am I driving you guys crazy?
No, you have to go on.
Beulah has invited Barney into her kitchen. Is it close? Beulah has invited Barney into her kitchen. She's so excited about having him and his pets into her apartment that she has to squeeze the muscular wall layers off of her rectum, otherwise she's going to pass wind. He tells her all that happened to him during the day. Beulah shakes her head in disbelief and sympathy, looking under the table to make sure that she's giving him enough leg room. Barney is enjoying the empathy. It's been a long time since he's had a woman in the kitchen feeling sorry for him. Beulah is fantasizing about making love with him out on the fire escape. The moon would be punched out, our bellies bloated with seafood. Nat King Cole singing A Blossom Fell on my hi-fi set. Her eyes are far away. Barney thinks she's bored. He doesn't know what to say next. He lights a cig. The spit of the match wakes her. Gee, I'm hungry. Would you like to get something to eat? Beulah asks. Barney's thinking, I gotta get the hell out of here. Beulah, you've been a swell host, but I gotta get to work. I gotta shave, juggle a few things, make a few phone calls. Beulah's crushed. She lets go of the chokehold on her rectum, inhales, moving it up and down into her tear glands. Mm-hmm. You could shave here, Barney. Use the phone here, Barney. I don't ever want you to leave, Barney.
Oh, she starts to laugh erotically. Well, I'm flattered to say the least. He puts his cig out, goes to the kitchen sink and throws water into his face, lathers up with a bar of soap. Beulah brings him a fresh razor. Well, what do you got to eat? He asks. Beulah dances over to the fridge, looks in. Barney steps up behind her. He peers over her shoulder, presses up against her, dripping suds onto her back. Beulah gives her behind a little wiggle. Wow, he says. How about some franks, she asks. Frankfurters, that's great. She throws in half a dozen into the pan. With wandering attention, she turns the flame ceiling high almost. Uh-oh. Beulah reaches for two plates in her cabinet. Barney moves with her to give her a hand. Face to face, they kiss, they hug, they dream. Frankfurter smoke is filling the kitchen. They both start coughing. Beulah runs to open the front door, turns on a fan. Barney, open some windows. There's nothing worse than the lingering smell of hot dogs. Do you know what I mean? Beulah's smiling. Barney's smiling, knowing that he's got a smart one here. Certainly, it's all those damn chemicals they put in him. Don't you just hate that, she says. You said a mouthful, all right, he says. You said a mouthful, too. Pretty darn original, I'd say. Mimics Big Toe in the living room, bringing up the flask of antifreeze to his lips.
Is that how it ends?
That's how it ends. Big Toe, the Irish setter, mocking them and their lovemaking. Pretty smell of hot dogs in the kitchen.
Wow, that's a crazy story.
Yeah, I like how the fish try to escape by swimming down into the basement of their Deglo castle
and there's
the
head shop. Well, that's a pretty good, castle.
Yeah,
for fish.
Yeah.
Fishbowl.
Antonio and the bee appreciated it. They obviously didn't know that it was there. They were discovering it for the first time.
So they were hiding.
They were hiding. They were hiding deep in the Deglo castle.
Yeah.
Because Big Toe wanted to get to him.
Yeah, Big Toe was hungry.
He was trying to...
Big Toe was well oiled.
He was trying to get back into nature.
He was liquored up on antifreeze and he knew he was overdoing it, so he tried to plug himself back into nature by barking.